Welcome to DC Special Cast, a proud member of the Fire and Water Podcast Network. I'm your host, Paul Ken. This podcast is an exploration of DC's special comics of the Bronze Age, which included such titles as the aptly named DC Special and Special Series, but also DC Superstars, Super DC Giant, Four-Star Superhero Spectacular, and many others. If you've read any of these comics, you know that they varied wildly in content, quality, and even format. They featured every possible genre of the comics industry at that time. Today, I am joined by a friend of the network and recently new podcaster, John Stibe. John, welcome to DC Special Cast.
Thank you for having me, Paul. I'm really excited. You and I were talking before we got started. Actually, this is the first time I'm recording for the Fire and Water Network, although it will probably come out after a different episode that I'm going to be recording. As far as why I'm here, I am a lifelong fan of comic books. I got my very first comic from the girl who lived next door when I was in first grade. She was in second grade, and she gave me a Tomb of Dracula comic that, to be honest with you, I did not like. I didn't like the drawings. I thought it was scary. I didn't like the words. I always tell this story as literally my first comic could have been my last, but the ads in that Marvel comic that showed Spider-Man, that showed Captain America, that showed the Hulk, I'm like, those guys look kind of interesting to me. And then I went to my local pharmacy where I grew up in southeastern Wisconsin, and I found those comics. And it's because of that girl who I have no idea where she is now. And people have asked me when I told that story, we still have that Tomb of Dracula comic. And I said, well, no, but eventually I went back and bought all the Tomb of Dracula comics so I could say I did. I couldn't tell you if it was issue 6 or issue 29. But I have read comics all my life. I'm not one of those people that went away and then came back. I read more at certain points in my life. Eventually, I got a job at a comic book store in Milwaukee called Collector's Edge Comics, and I worked there for over 20 years.
Wow.
While some of it in the end was just on Sundays because I was going back to school to become a school teacher. I'm an elementary school teacher. I teach fifth and sixth grade. And so the comic store was great when I was going back to school because I could work nights. Mm-hmm. And then when I eventually got a full-time teaching job, I would be basically just working on Sundays or maybe mm-hmm. Saturdays and Sundays. And in the end, finally, my wife, when we had our daughter, she's like, you don't have to be gone every Sunday, do you? So then I finally said goodbye to the comic shop, which was tough. The idea of being at a comic shop, I was there in the 90s for all the crazy. I was there for the death of Superman. I was there for the wedding of Lois and Clark, Image Comics, and all of the stuff that happened around that. But jumping all the way back out of there, I discovered the Fire and Water Network by accident. I was a huge fan of the Who's Who comic, and I had bought them originally. And for some reason, I was looking them up online, and I saw that there was a podcast about it. And I'm like, there's no way they're going to talk about every single issue of Who's Who. I went to the website, and there were like 12 pages, and you had to back arrow to go back to the first one. And I got to that first one. I heard the song for the first time, and I couldn't figure out who 2D Man was, and that bothered me. All of a sudden, I started listening and just became a fan. And that led to not only getting caught up eventually, but that led to me finding other shows, enjoying other shows. And then like this show, I said, is just perfect for me because I'm a huge fan of the DC Special books. And your intro explains it perfectly. They're all so different, like Three Musketeers in one and like Love 1971 in the other one. They're terrible to file when you're trying to put your comics in order. It's just really tough. And then you look it up and it's because it's under C-247 or whatever it is. So, huge fan of this show and the network, and the opportunity to talk to you is just, I'm beside myself with excitement.
Oh, that's awesome. Well, thank you for sharing your secret origin there, John. We'll get to what we're talking about in a minute, but we'll probably give it away a little bit because we're going to take a moment to thank our sponsors. This episode of DC Special Cast is sponsored in part by InStockTrades.com. InStockTrades is your best online source for trades, hardcovers, and other collected editions. Offer up to 40% off with free shipping for $50 or more orders. John, do you have a recommendation?
Well, because I'm new, naturally, and super excited, I have two recommendations.
That's totally fine.
Like you mentioned, we're going to reveal what it is. My first recommendation is JL Ape, the Complete Collection trade paperback from DC Comics. I have that as kind of my second choice, because I'm going to get to the other one in a second. I was not a huge fan of the Jail Ape annuals when they came out, but man, they had the sweetest covers by Art Adams. And they were fun for the time, but I just thought beyond the name, these could be better stories. But having said that, on in-stock trades, it's $29.99, but now it's reduced. You save 40%, it's $17.99. And for $17.99, just getting those Art Adams covers, I own all the annuals, and I think I paid probably $2.95 for each one or whatever it was. So $17.99 is a steal.
Excellent.
The other choice that I have is actually something that I literally have in front of me, which is called DC Finest Science Fiction, The Gorilla World. I love the DC Finest books. I know you've recommended some too. I love the Marvel Epic Collections too. And I was working at a comic shop when the Epic Collections came out, and I thought, how dumb is this? They're starting with volume 8. How long are they going to last? And now I got a whole bookshelf full of Epic Collections. I think it's wonderful, all the different stuff that they did. I'm really glad that DC has jumped on to this one. The science fiction, the Gorilla World one, I got as a Christmas gift for my family. So I think that's really nice too. Haven't cracked it open yet, but I recommend it just as the cover. And what I like about the DC Finest and the Marvel Epic stuff, like I said, is I want my family members to get me stuff for Christmas that I want instead of socks and underwear.
Yeah.
So the idea of being able to share links from in-stock trades to have them do it. This one was $39.99, and that one's 42% off for $23.19. It just looks sweet on the shelf with my other DC Finest.
Yeah, no, they're great. And you get great prices at in-stock trades for the finest collections. I've got a whole bunch of them too. It's fantastic. My recommendation is an Epic Collection, the Planet of the Apes Epic Collection, Volume 1, Original Marvel Years. The simian sci-fi staple in the Mighty Marvel Manor relives the classic film Planet of the Apes and Beneath the Planet of the Apes, and they're collected in one action-packed volume. It collects the adventures on the Planet of the Apes numbers 1 to 11. 224 pages, full color. It was $34.99. In stock trades price is $22.74. Save 35%. We've kind of given it away, although probably from social media, people will know what they're listening to anyway. Today, our comic is an odd one. Talk about challenges of filing your collection. This comic is not part of DC Special or DC Special Series or DC Superstars, any of that stuff. It's actually a one-shot, which you didn't get very many back in 1976. It's called Superheroes Battle Super Gorillas. It was on sale September 16th, 1976, labeled Winter 1976. And if you look inside at the indicia, it says published quarterly. Now, there were no other issues that came out. I don't know whether this was part of the Jeanette Kahn, you know, we're not doing all these reprint books kind of stuff. I didn't look up the timing of it or whatever, but it is real oddity because it's the only issue of the series, and you didn't get a lot of that in 1976. It was a 50-cent cover price, giant sized, for 48 pages, edited by Julie Schwartz. In terms of value, Wayne Special Investments, this book's a little more expensive than some of the other ones. Not sure why, other than it's a little harder to find. There are a few copies listed online. Nice ones run, you know, maybe $10 to $20. And there were a couple lower grades listed under $10. I'm pretty sure you can get it under $10 at a show if you're lucky enough to find it. Now, John, you have a physical copy, right?
Yes, I do. Two of them.
Two of them? Why two?
So I originally bought this at the ripe old age of 8 in 1976. And I adore this comic. At least I adored the cover because that's the part that I remembered. The inside, when I revisited the last couple of weeks, I couldn't have told you those stories, but I can close my eyes and see this cover. Having said that, when I had the opportunity from you to talk about a comic, a special that I would like to talk about, I jumped at this one, knowing full well that I would be able to find it in my own collection, and I couldn't. So I eventually had to go on eBay. What you weren't wrong, I paid on eBay for just under $10 and then some shipping, a copy that's not in great shape, but it's a comic and it smells like a comic and
It smells like 1976, right?
it does. It smells like old comics. When I was looking through my collection to find that one, I found a whole slew of other not only gorilla comics, but just comics with monkeys in them and the whole thing. So it's just funny that after purchasing it on eBay, I'm like, now watch, I'll find it the next day. No, I've been looking for other stuff and I still can't find it. But I know I have two. Eventually, they'll be next to each other.
There you go. This is a reprint book, so I thought also I'd look at what the originals are worth. The Superman story we're going to hear comes from Action Comics number 238 from 1958. So to give you some context, that's before the introduction of Brainiac and Supergirl. So that's something. A low-grade copy of that runs about $30 to $40, but I did see a CGC 9.0 going for $650. The Flash story comes from Flash 172, 1967, and that runs anywhere from $20 to $40. And finally, the Batman story comes from Batman number 75, 1953, by far the most expensive. Every one that I saw on eBay when I looked were graded, and they run from $300 for a CGC 2.5 to $800 for a 6.0. There was a coverless one somebody was asking $75 for. So if you want to read these stories, you know, spending $10 is actually a pretty good deal, right? But my copy as well is the one I bought for 50 cents off the rack when I was a kid, 1976. Do you want to talk anything more about why you love this comic so much?
Yeah. The other thought that I had was, well, I know I have some of these things because of DC Infinite. And DC Infinite is a friend to me and my back when I'm pulling long boxes down from shelves in my basement. Mm-hmm. And sure enough, the only one of these three that was on DC Infinite is the Flash reprint. The other ones are not on there.
Yep.
And then I realized that I had a collection called DC Goes Ape, which was also a collection of guerrilla stories. And I'm like, oh, this is perfect. This will have them in there. None of them are in there. So I kept trying to stave off having to buy a second copy. I'd rather use my money to buy other comics than to buy duplicate comics. Even with that other trade, I still couldn't find those stories. So yeah, the money was well spent to get that one.
Excellent. You might ask, what's the deal with gorillas? DC in particular, why do they love them so much? For this episode, I thought I'd do a little mini history of monkeys and apes in comics. So there's a great article from 2017 at comicsalliance.com that I took a lot of info from. So check out their website. In addition, I have to mention there was a recent issue of Back Issue, number 163, it just came out a couple months ago, that is entirely devoted to gorillas and monkeys in comics, which is great. So links to both of them will be included in the show notes. If we think back to the beginnings of comics, 1930s, what was some other popular entertainment at the time? Well, 1933, there was a King Kong movie. The Tarzan Daily comic strip by Bern Hogarth was in every living room in America, not to mention the Johnny Weissmuller Tarzan film. So this kind of stuff was in the zeitgeist of the country at the time. So as a result, we got a number of comic books like Jungle Comics from Fiction House, and that ran 163 issues from 1940 to 1954. Tarzan, of course, had an ongoing comic book, which had an uninterrupted run from various publishers, including Marvel and DC, but it ran from 1948 to 1979, which is amazing. And in those books, gorillas were often used as a threat, as well as some comedy relief and humor strips. But there were soon ape characters in superhero comics, too. Giganta first appeared in 1944. It's hard to remember when you look at the giant redhead bombshell, but she was a gorilla mutated into a giant human by an evil scientist to take on Wonder Woman. 1940 also saw the debut of Congo Bill. But for the first part of his career, he was just a jungle explorer, a lot like other characters. Nothing was really too notable about him, but we'll come back to Congo Bill in a bit. But 1951 was a turning point. That year, Strange Adventures number 8 was published, featuring the incredible story of an ape with a human brain. Apparently, it sold pretty well. Julie Schwartz later recalled that, quote, Irwin Donnerfield called me and said we should try it again. Eventually, all the editors wanted to use gorilla covers, and he said no more than one a month. Soon they were pushing that one gorilla a month rule to the limit. DC's sci-fi and fantasy and horror titles such as Strange Adventures and Tales of the Unexpected became notorious for their gorilla covers. Superheroes were getting into the mix, too, with Batman fighting the gorilla boss of Gotham, Batman 75, which we're going to talk about today. Superboy battled King Gorilla in Adventure Comics number 196 and 54. And Wonder Woman, strangely, was playing baseball with a gorilla in Wonder Woman number 78, 1955. Once the Silver Age proper was in full swing by the late 1950s, things began to go, well, bananas. Probably the most famous of the gorillas of this era is Gorilla Grodd, who first appears in 1959's Flash number 106. And soon, Grodd brings with him a whole gorilla city, including his opposite number, the heroic Solivar. We will read, of course, one of Grodd's stories today. This period also saw the debut of the villainous Monsieur Mala in the pages of the Doom Patrol, Buona Beast's sidekick Duba, Animal Man's foe, the mod gorilla boss, and the cartoonist slash detective Sam Simeon from the pages of Angel and the Ape, and numerous one-off gorillas in anthology books like The House of Secrets and even Star-Spangled War Stories. In the Superman books, you got Jimmy Olsen, who seemed to get either his brain swapped with a gorilla or marry one every other month. The Man of Steel himself confronted several gorilla foes, including Chandu the gorilla with X-ray eyes, the Super 8 from Krypton, King Krypton, the super gorilla, that's the one we're going to talk about today. And most famously, of course, Titano the super ape, a pretty transparent King Kong ripoff with the added danger of his kryptonite vision, which I always thought was funny. And then we get back to Congo Bill, who for years been coasting by as a moderately successful ripoff of Alex Raymond's Jungle Jim in the pages of More Fun Comics than then eventually Action Comics. However, in Action number 248, Bill found himself able, by means of a magic ring, to transfer his mind into the body of a golden gorilla, a legendary beast he had encountered several times before. The newly fused Bill slash Gorilla combo was known as Congorilla, and therefore the feature would be retitled for the rest of the run, first in Action and later in Adventure Comics. Well, with all this talk of DC gorillas, you may be wondering, where are all the Marvel gorillas? Well, there just aren't that many. They would have published three different characters called Gorilla Man. Ken Hale, who first appeared in 1954's Men's Adventures, who would much, much later be used by Jeff Parker and Leonard Kirk in Agents of Atlas, which is a pretty good book. The villainous Dr. Arthur Nagin, who first appeared in 1954's Mystery Tales number 21, but who would gain notoriety in 1970s as a member of the Defenders villains, the Headmen. And Frank Radzik, a scientist who transfers his brain into a gorilla's body in the pages of 1962's Tales to Astonish. There were also, of course, the superpowered apes of the Red Ghost, but by the time the 70s rolled around, the popularity of some of these ape characters seemed to wane, and perhaps this comic was a way to see if there was still an interest. Since there was only one issue, no, maybe not. But through the bronze and modern ages, we still have seen quite a lot of monkey business. We saw Ape X, the intellectual ape with tank tread legs from the Squadron Supreme by Mark Grunwald and Bob Hall. The Primate Patrol, a squad of Nazi gorillas in Weird War Tales. I didn't know that one. That's a funny one. Of course, the Ultra Humanite, who had been one, if not the first ever super villain in comics, was given new life in 1981 when his mind was transferred into the body of a powerful albino ape. Cygor, a spittle mouth cyborg ape from the pages of Spawn, who I had not heard of until I read this article. I think I read the first two issues of Spawn and never since. Axwell Tiberius from Monkey Man and O'Brien by Art Adams, your favorite there. I think that's probably why they got him to do those covers for AJL Ape. And King Solomon from Alan Moore and King Sprouse's Tom Strong, another great comic, many others. And then finally, we have to mention 1999's JL Ape, which John already mentioned, an event that ran through all the DC annuals and saw most of the heroes change into gorillas. Finally, I'll note that in other media, Gorilla Grodd in particular has been very prominent in DC animation, and they did a pretty good job of him too in the live-action Flash TV show. And it appears he'll be in the Jimmy Olsen TV show on HBO Max when that comes out, but we'll see. So, John, I know you pulled a bunch of other ape-like comics that you want to talk about, so let me hear what you like about ape comics.
It's funny because there's the issue of Secret Origins, maybe 50, where there's a bunch of monkeys on the cover, and one of them's riding a bike, and he's crying or whatever, and it even says on the cover, read the letters page for why this monkey is crying, something like that. And then the idea behind just putting a gorilla on the cover that would make it sell is something that, even if that wasn't true, it's now become like comic book urban legend that that's dinosaurs and gorillas and purple covers and people crying. I do want to mention Agents of Atlas was one of my favorite books, just really, really well done because it spins out of one of my favorite issues of What If. The What If where the Avengers were formed in the 1950s, that original one, just so great. I'm also a huge fan of Squadron Supreme, so I'm glad you mentioned Apex. I wrote down Gore, the Golden Gorilla, which is the one that I think Roy Thomas created in that issue of FF. I think it's Gore. There was a really bad post-Marvel Zombies Marvel event called Marvel Apes, which was a 5-issue miniseries and a couple of one-shots. This would have been in the late 90s, I think, or early 2000s.
Wow, I don't even remember that.
It was not good. I mean, it was, I want to say Carl Kiesel, but that might not be true. And I probably shouldn't throw him under the bus until I check. While I was looking for that one comic that I had to buy twice, I actually found the DC special number 16 that has superheroes battling super gorillas. And of course, I assumed that's going to have everything that's in this one, but it doesn't. It has different ones. So I have something else to read, but I think you're going to do that one with somebody else in the future. I found my copy of Flash Dollar Comics from 1978 that not only has Grodd in it, it also has Jay Garrick, Kid Flash, and a special guest star of Johnny Quick, which also ties into my love for the JSA and the Golden Age characters too.
That one's on the remit for DC Special Cast because that's a DC Special Series comic.
So yeah, those were the ones that just coming across some of the ones when I'm, you know, you're looking for a monkey comic and all of a sudden you're like, oh, I got one. Oh no, there's another monkey comic. You mentioned a whole bunch of spectrum that I just, it's so much fun. I don't know why we like it so much, but I chuckled out loud that as a kid, I probably wouldn't have bought a Wonder Woman comic, but a Wonder Woman comic where she's playing baseball with a gorilla, that I would buy.
Oh boy. Let's talk about our timeline. For historical context, this comic, believe it or not, actually came out the same month as the comic I covered in the very first episode of DC Special Cast. That was DC Special Cast number 10, The Strange Sports Stories that I did with Max Romero. I won't retread old material, but there are certainly some terrific DC comics out that month, like JLA 137 with Superman versus Captain Marvel, recently covered by the Earth 2 podcast. And then for Marvel, given our theme today, I must mention that there were Adventures of the Planet of the Apes number 11, the last issue of that series in the book I recommended, and 5 issues of the Planet of the Apes UK Weekly. For other publishers, I couldn't find any gorillas, but at least the $6 million man does get to fight an alligator in his comic this month. So, John, did you have any favorites from this month?
I absolutely did. There's so many, and you had mentioned a bunch of them. Because I was 8 years old, these are the comics that I kind of part of my DNA. Action Comics 466, where Lex Luthor is killing Kid Superman, and it's not Superboy, but it's that is burned into my brain. JL of a 137 that you mentioned with Superman and Captain Marvel. I remember buying Peter Parker the Spectacular Spider-Man number 1 off the rack,
yep,
with the tarantula on the cover. So there's, yep, so many of those. Now I look back and I'm like, maybe I didn't buy them first run, but I might have bought them by mail order after we were really, really collecting. The one thing I didn't mention in my origin was I have a brother who's 5 years older than I am. I take full credit for buying the comics and reading the comics, but he started reading mine. And then all of a sudden we were collecting together, which is a really nice thing for us to do.
That's
and
fun.
My brother was very into the idea of taking a little notebook and writing down the ones we have. We bought Marvel Tales and we would write it down that we'd have Amazing Spider-Man number, whatever. And he was really on top of it. And I, being 5 years younger, just wanted to read the stories. And so his thing was much more organized and uniform. Eventually, without going into detail, I ended up kind of giving him my half of the collection because I had started over without telling him and I was buying comics that he didn't even know I was buying. And I just kept buying. So that's something that I really should have mentioned before, because it's a really important part that I send him comic book stuff now. He doesn't read anything new now. He's not buying anything new, but I send him stuff. I'm going to send him a link to this episode and beg him to listen to it. The other thing that I wanted to mention was DC Superstars number 10. DC Superstars number 10, the baseball issue, that was the first episode of this show, which was a really good way to hook me into listening to this show. One of my all-time favorite comics. And just today, I listened to an interview with Bob Rozakis, and he talked about how he used to do the AOL Monday Night Anything Goes chat stuff. And it's a really interesting interview that you can probably find on YouTube. Bob Rozakis is talking to the guy from Word Balloon.
John
and
Sanchez,
he talks,
yeah,
about how they had trivia, because of course he's the answer man. And if you won the trivia, I was on AOL using dial up in the 90s, which was tricky just to get on there. Not only did I win the trivia one time, he sent me the original script of DC Special number 10.
No way!
Signed by him. It's got handwritten notes. It's got a rusty staple in it. I have access at the school I teach at to a scanner, and I need to scan this thing and save it for posterity.
Yeah.
But things crossed off and written over about the baseball game.
That's so cool.
One of my prized possessions. So that's why I was saving that as kind of a surprise for you, Paul.
That's awesome. Yeah, you definitely have to scan it. I'd love to see that. Send me the scan. That'd be awesome. If you send me a page or two, I'll put it in the gallery for this time too.
I will do that.
That was a great surprise.
I posted, I think on Back Issue one time, that Bob had sent the stuff, but I've never scanned it because it's silly, because it's just, it's type paper and there's handwritten stuff, and I need to save it in case there was ever a flood or a fire. I almost feel like I have like documents here, like the Constitution. I shouldn't take the stamp. He mentioned sending prizes to people of just stuff that he had around. I have a couple of different things. His trivia stuff was just so wonderful. And obviously I really love the fact that you're also doing the Daily Planet pages, or will be doing the Daily Planet pages later after Catch You Later Calculator. I can't wait for those pages too. So this show is made for me, Paul.
Oh, I'm glad to hear it. That's awesome. So how about we talk about the comic?
I think we should.
John, do you want to describe the cover and give us your thoughts? Imprinted in your brain, you said.
That's right. I absolutely love this cover. As I said, enough to own two copies of it now. I looked this up because I'm not a big movie guy. And the Dino De Laurentiis King Kong movie came out in December of 1976, which I don't even know if I ever have seen to this day. But I remember all the ads that were in the comics at the time because Kong was standing on the two twin towers of the World Trade Center in the ad. Because this cover definitely channeling that. I think Ernie Chan did just an amazing job. Superman is punching. Batman is swinging in from the side, Flash is vibrating, but poor Robin, the weakest character this bunch, sorry Robin fans, is actually getting the Fay Wray treatment. I just love this cover. And again, like I said, I think I love it even more than I love the insides.
I love the artwork on the cover. I mean, the gorilla is not super realistic. He's also gigantic.
Yes.
He's way bigger than any of the men. The only things I don't like about it, and I'm sure we'll get a comment from Martin Gray about the logo. He likes to comment on the logos. The logo's pretty meh. It's pretty much the same thing they used on that other DC special that you mentioned, but it's just a giant S and then text superheroes battle super gorillas, where the giant S works for both superheroes and super gorillas. So that's kind of boring if you ask me. But other than that, it's a cool cover. There was a span of time there that we've talked about where Ernie Chan was the cover guy for DC for like a year or two. Let's open up the book. Now, we'll have to say that when you open up the book, before we even get to the story, there is a Hostess Pie ad. And, you know, I have to mention this. I'm contractually obligated to my podcast partner, Sean. This one stars the Joker. The funniest part about this one is that the Joker says he doesn't like Hostess fruit pies, which I think is the only time somebody says they don't like the product in these things. And the police who capture him are like, man, you're crazy for not liking those. I just had to mention that because that's just fun. So our first story is called The Super Gorilla from Krypton. It's a 12-pager written by Otto Binder with art by Wayne Boring and Stan Kay, the standard Superman team in the 50s. And like I said before, it was reprinted from Action Comics number 238 in 1958. So the only other place it's been reprinted other than this comic was in Superman Annual number 7 from 1963. It hasn't even made it to an omnibus yet. It, in fact, will actually be in the last Golden Age omnibus to come out, since the Silver Age omnibus, which has come out, that started with Action number 241. So it's going to be like one of the last stories of considered, quote, the Golden Age of Superman. And unfortunately, as John mentioned, it's not on DC Universe Infinite. So John, do you want to summarize the story for our listeners?
Yeah. Jimmy Olsen is on assignment to photograph modern Africa, and he runs into a superpowered ape because, of course, he's Jimmy Olsen. Z, Z, Z. At least that's how I always read it. The call from his signal watch goes out, and Superman arrives just in time to save Jimmy, again, from being crushed by his own Jeep. Superman tries to cage the beast, but is unsuccessful. The Man of Steel speculates that the ape was sent into space from Krypton as a test and therefore has the same powers as he does. Jimmy names the gorilla King Krypton as the ape begins to create havoc. But every time Superman uses his powers to fix the damage done by King Krypton, the ape learns that he has a new superpower. He even steals Superman's cape. Superman sends Jimmy off to look for kryptonite, since he can't do that himself, to use against the ape. While looking, Jimmy happens to find a replica of the Colosseum and natives descended from Romans to boot. He calls for Superman, but when the Metropolis Marvel arrives, he discovers that the Roman spears have kryptonite points, because of course they do. This is probably my favorite part. Jimmy can converse with the tribe in Latin, because as I was reading it, I was thinking, how can he talk to them? He can talk in Latin, so good job, Metropolis school system. The chief demands that Superman and King Krypton fight a battle in the Colosseum, with the winner earning his freedom. The pair pretty much wreck the arena and expose even more kryptonite. Apparently, there's a lot of it there in modern Africa. Superman lays dying, but then King Krypton shields Superman, sacrificing himself. The eight then reverts to human form and explains that he was a Kryptonian scientist who'd been working on an evolution accelerating ray. Like all good comic book scientists, he tries it on himself. But the ray worked in reverse and de-evolved him into the giant ape. His friend shot him into space, hoping that the cosmic rays would reverse the damage. But alas, Krypton blew up and he had no place to return to. He had temporarily gone mad, but the kryptonite reversed his condition enough for his human intelligence to take over. He dies, having saved Superman, but at least as a human again. The end.
Wow. John, tell me what you thought of this story after not having read it for 40 years.
I have to be honest, I wasn't crazy about the story when I read it back then, and it's probably silly, my reasons. Rereading it now, I find it, of course, charming and fun. But back then, as a discerning 8-year-old, I thought King Krypton was a strange name. I guess I thought Krypton Kong would have been better, maybe. I get the connection to Kong, but King Krypton made me think of a royalty character who should be like wearing a crown or something. That's probably a different issue of Jimmy Olsen. And then he reverts back to human and then dies. What was really strange is his head turned back to human first, and he still had a gorilla body, and it was just disturbing.
This is a wild, crazy story. Let's walk through it because there's a lot of great sections of this. Before we do that, I'd like to talk about the art. Got Wayne Boring here, barrel-chested Superman. The gorilla's got another barrel chest, but it's also his belly area is big. Definitely thick. Heavy set people. You can tell it's Wayne Boring just by looking at it.
Absolutely. My earliest Superman comics were Kurt Swan. So until John Byrne came along, Kurt Swan was my Superman guy. And so when I read this, probably even as a kid, buying contemporary at the time Superman comics, I'm like, why do the heads look smaller than the bodies on this? And so you're right, the barrel-chested thing, it's very identifiable to me when I became a well-read comic book fan. And now I can recognize it as Wayne Boring. But what I wanted to know then was, why doesn't he look like he does in the issues of Action?
Yep. I think the gorilla is not terribly realistic. The other characters, it's a little stiff, but the storytelling's good. You know what's happening. Pack a lot into these stories back then. And so the artists are really challenged. There's lots of words crowding all the images a lot. The first couple pages, we see Jimmy doing a photo assignment in tame Africa. So they make a big deal at the beginning of they're driving a car and there's a paved street and a gas station. And Jimmy's like, whoa, that doesn't look very wild in terms of Africa. But of course, they get right out and they encounter this giant super gorilla. Gorilla comes after him. Jimmy's driving the Jeep. And one guy starts shooting the gorilla, but the bullets bounce off him because he's super gorilla. And the ape comes after the Jeep. And that's when Jimmy hits his signal watch. So Jimmy's in Africa. Okay, Superman, Clark Kent, he rips open his shirt. He says, oh, I see with my telescopic vision, Jimmy's in trouble again. And man, he's fast because he gets there by the time the ape has thrown the Jeep, which is, like 2 seconds later. So I like this part, but it's a good setup for the story, I thought.
Yeah, I agree. I remember rereading it now thinking, well, I'm glad Superman wasn't doing something else, like saving somebody else, that he's just hanging out waiting to hear the signal watch.
The next section I think was fun, pages 3 to 5, where you see the ape mimicking the humans, especially Superman. I love the part where Superman does something and the ape's like, oh, I can do that. Superman builds a cage out of steel. The ape rips right through it. He starts to fly because he sees Superman fly. And then Superman sees a spaceship. So he speculates at the time, again, 1958, they were shooting apes and dogs and things in space, right? So that's what Superman at the time makes total sense for him to assume that. So I thought that was a nice contemporaneous add there. So that's pretty cool. Then the ape jumps up and damages a plane. Superman fix it. But my favorite page, I think, of the story is page 6. So much happens on this page. Number one, the ape steals Superman's cape and puts it on and flies away. And that is just a fun image. Two, Superman then decides to send Jimmy out to just look for some kryptonite. So kryptonite is so plentiful. He's like, hey, Jimmy, go look for some kryptonite, will you? And Jimmy's like, okay, sure. And then third, on his way to look for kryptonite, Jimmy comes upon a lost Roman tribe with a replica Colosseum. I mean, wow.
What a coincidence.
I love this. I don't know why they needed to have a Roman Colosseum, why it couldn't have been just native dwellers of Africa or something,
Yeah, they could just have people there.
but I guess it's so Jimmy could converse in Latin, which was on the next page, which is a riot. I just loved all that. I thought as you as a teacher would love that Jimmy's using Latin to converse with these guys.
Yeah, I teach 5th and 6th grade. We don't do a lot with Latin. We do actually teach Spanish, but we don't do a lot with Latin. I think because of it being the Colosseum, too, they had to be, let's have a gladiator fight. Very unusual choice.
So then we get the section where Superman hears Jimmy buzzing him because he found the tribe, but Superman flies into the trap because the Romans have kryptonite-tipped spears, because why not? I guess it's a hard rock. They carved the spear
Sure.
shapes out of it.
Green, it probably glows. That would be helpful with my spears.
And so Superman and King Krypton are both weakened by that. And then the leader of the Romans say, all right, well, you guys have to fight. Okay, well, because what else do you do in a Colosseum but have a gladiator contest, man versus animal? Superman is still without his cape. And so I know my partner Sean loves anytime the costumes are a little different, a little out of whack. Superman without a cape fighting the gorilla with a cape right up his alley. They start fighting. They're picking up trees, they're throwing giant rocks. It's just great. So then the ape takes a giant tree and hammers Superman into the ground. They swing each other around, they start wrecking the place. And eventually, a crack opens up in the ground. And what's in there but a giant kryptonite rock?
Giant kryptonite rock, like really big.
Yes, maybe this is where they carved all their spears out of.
I guess.
I guess this part's kind of neat because the ape recognizes it. At this point, I guess he's starting to regain his intelligence. And so the ape blocks Superman, and we get that panel at the bottom of this page where he's starting to turn back into a human, and just his head is human and the rest of his body is the ape, which is, I agree, very disturbing. I had the same note. And he tells Superman the story on the next page. His story is another crazy story. Number one, he's a scientist, invents this evolution accelerator ray. Number two, he tries it on himself. Number three, it doesn't work. It, in fact, reverse evolutionizes him instead. So it works exactly the opposite of what he thinks. Number three, his pals shoot him into space in hopes that cosmic rays will cure him for some reason. And then, oh, too bad. That's when Krypton blows up.
Right then.
I'm like, this guy's got it rough. It is kind of sad that the guy had to die.
There's so much that happens. That's true of late Golden Age, Silver Age comics and stuff. But I mean, even that last page, like you said, in six panels, there's just so much that's happening. And it's just now it's crazy fun ideas. When I was 8 years old, it still would have been crazy fun ideas. But we look at it going, wow, there's an awful lot that goes on there.
We laugh at this stuff a lot, but I love it. It's fun. It's crazy. Again, 1958, this was being written for, 6 to 12 year olds. And this is terrific. And then he reverts to human form. He turns all green, which was a very early instance of kryptonite poisoning. I read it somewhere and didn't put it in the thing, but I think this might be the first time where we see a Kryptonian who's poisoned by kryptonite turning green as they die. We see that a lot later years, of course, including the famous, Neil Adams cover where he's turning green. But I think I read somewhere that this is the first time that was the way that the kryptonite poisoning evidenced itself, which I thought was pretty neat.
Well, and I may not know much science beyond fifth and sixth grade science, but him laying his Kryptonian body on top of the meteor, which was pretty big, is apparently enough to shield all the radiation. And when he's green, Superman's just standing there in the background. He's talking, but he's 20 feet away, maybe. And then he puts his cape back on. Maybe Superman should get in that Jeep that was thrown and maybe get a little farther away. That rock is still there. Like he's still there.
Yeah, I do like in the last panel, Superman's taking his cape. Jimmy had pulled it off of the body, and Superman's reattaching his cape. So that's a nice little artistic touch that you don't have to do, which is kind of nice. But it is kind of a bittersweet thing. But of course, back then, again, this is before Supergirl, there were no other Kryptonians yet. So the Mort Weisinger era of lots of Kryptonians is about to start. And so, but we're not quite there yet. Final thoughts on this story, John, before we move on?
No, I think we've definitely got a really, really interesting story. I do want to say that I did a little bit of searching, and apparently King Krypton has not come back, hasn't shown up in a new version or an altered version or anything like that. Because at the end of the story, when he dies, you're like, well, he's going to come back again. That was it.
One and done. All right, let's move on to our second story. And now we're in the Silver Age, and it's starring the Flash. It's entitled Grodd Puts the Squeeze on the Flash. It's 12 pages, written by John Broome, art by Carmine Infantino and Sid Green, and reprinted from Flash number 172, as I mentioned before, 1967. This one has been reprinted in lots of places. It's in the Showcase Flash Volume 4. It's in the Silver Age Omnibus Volume 3. It'll probably be in a forthcoming DC Finest. And the Flash 172 is available on DC Universe Infinite for any of you who want to read along. The Flash discovers that the people of Central City have suddenly become possessed with super speed. The city is also cut off from the outside world by an impenetrable barrier. Barry checks in with Dr. Torrance, a scientist friend, who informs him that the people of Central City are also aging at this accelerated rate. And if this situation isn't resolved soon, they will all die from old age. Flash then receives a telepathic message from Gorilla Grodd, who claims responsibility for the situation. He blackmails Flash into freeing him from a cell in Gorilla City to remove the effect before all the people in Central City die. Flash reluctantly agrees to Grodd's condition and releases the Super 8. Grodd apparently fixes the situation and goes off on his way, warning the Flash not to interfere with his plans or else he will speed up the whole world this time. Grodd then demands that the world leaders surrender control to him. Flash is trying to figure out what to do, how to stop him, and he goes back to visit Dr. Torrance. Torrance tells him that he has determined that Grodd is bluffing. He thinks that the time speed-up was actually caused by a rare solar event, which cannot be repeated. But Torrance's computer would not be able to confirm his calculations until after Grodd's deadline is up. Flash solves that problem by doing the math at super speed. Yay for math. Flash then tries to recapture Grodd. The gorilla is ready for his foe, but the Scarlet Speedster still prevails, including using a cool trip to vibrate out of his uniform and clobber him as Barry Allen. Grodd is sent back to his jail cell in Gorilla City. The end. So, John, what do you think of this story?
Oh, I love The Flash, and I have since I was a brand new comic reader. But I didn't really recall the details of this story until I reread it recently. I love Grodd as a villain, as a character, but the revelation in the story that it was a, quote, rare solar event coincidence seemed weird to me. My question was, it just happened in Central City? It didn't happen because there was that dome over the city? And those people didn't crash into stuff when they were moving at super speed? The super speed pages of the normal people are wonderful, like super well drawn and super fun. But at the same time, I'm like, if everybody was moving at super speed, aren't they like bumping into stuff? It was kind of anticlimactic that the hero saved the day by calling the villain's bluff. I do love the math part, of course. Mm-hmm. Did I like it? Yes. Did I scratch my head back then about it? Probably. I hope I did.
This is prime Carmine Infantino. We've talked about it on various shows before. Carmine gets to the late 70s and 80s when he's doing Spider-Woman and stuff. And then when he came back to The Flash, when I was that age, I didn't care for his art. But boy, some of these Flash stories is really terrific. These pages that you mentioned, these first couple pages where all the people are vibrating and Barry's like, whoa, and then he has to adjust his own vibrational rate so he can see them and converse with them are terrific. His gorilla, Grodd, is better. Still not ultra realistic like we get today. He's not as gigantic as the other two gorillas in the book, but I think Gorilla Grodd is more like what an actual size gorilla is. Not that I'm a gorilla expert, but yeah, great stuff. One more thing before we get started. I love Silver Age Flash for the science. I mean, it's comic book science, okay, with vibrations and stuff, but there's a premise. There's a scientist, and they solve their problems using their brains, believe in science, you know, and in this day and age, it's just nice to see people with confidence in science. So I love the Silver Age Flash for that. I just had
and
to
I
say
couldn't
that.
Agree more. I actually tell people that I learned the color spectrum of the rainbow because of Rainbow Raider being Roy G. Bivolo, as silly as that sounds, because I can tell my students that and they'll be like, yeah, Roy G. Biv. And I'm like, but you don't understand. That's the real name of the Rainbow Raider. And they're all like, we don't care.
That's funny.
I love the science.
So again, we get these first couple pages where Iris is giving Barry some breakfast, but she's moving super fast and Barry is trying to figure out what's going on. She runs off to work. He goes visit his scientist friends because Barry has lots of scientist friends because of course he does. He's a theoretical physicist. Why Barry picks this guy to talk to, you know, we don't know, but it doesn't matter. And he says there's also this barrier. Barry can't get through the barrier. And that's when Gorilla Grodd contacts the Flash. In my mind, by the way, despite what we know at the end of this giant coincidence, it's a pretty slick plan by Grodd. Somehow he discovered that this was going to happen, as much as we think it's silly that that coincidental event is happening. But somehow Grodd figures it out. From there, the story makes good logic sense, right? Grodd's like, how can I use this to my advantage? I'll get out of prison and I'll threaten to bring it back. And, you know, I'll consolidate my power before they figured it out. But of course, the Flash figures it out fast enough that he's able to stop him. But I thought the plan by Grodd was, you know, in a lot of the stories of this age, the plan of the villains, you're scratching your head. You know, you mentioned the calculator. Man, his plans, I'm always scratching my head. We get the conclusion of that at the end of this episode today. You'll have to wait and listen, listeners, to whether we find out what his real plan was all along or not. So then Flash takes him out of prison. These pages are good. You see Flash dragging him out of prison over all across the ocean, back to Central City. Grodd snaps his fingers and everything goes back to normal. He runs off and Flash is like, what do I do? I really like that.
I guess I didn't understand. I mean, Grodd obviously understood that the rare solar event was forcing people to speed up, again, just in Central City. Mm-hmm. And it was also creating the dome that he was able to explain to Flash how, in order to break through the dome, what you have to do is run at it really hard, which wasn't one of Barry's ideas, was running at it really hard. And then when he snaps his fingers, he's like, well, see ya. And then he goes on TV to tell him, I'm going to do it again, unless you do what? Let me take over the world? The city? City Hall?
Flash is like, really not sure what to do. He hears from a police officer that Dr. Torrance wants to see him again. He rushes over there. And Dr. Torrance is like, hey, I think Grodd's bluffing. Before the world turns over power to Grodd as the ruler of the world, my computer's not fast enough to figure it out. And so this is my favorite part here. The Flash does the math at super speed as a math geek, as a former actuary, and you as a teacher. I mean, I just love the fact that Flash uses math to solve the problem. It's not real math, comic book math, comic book science, but that's okay. He uses math to solve the problem. And then he knows, you know what? Grodd is full of it. And then we get great action scenes. This story is a little light on action. Second to last page is a great art of Grodd holding the Flash in a big bear hug. I didn't quite follow this. Grodd has enough of a grip on his costume, but Flash is able to vibrate out of the costume through Grodd's arms out into the street, and he's Barry Allen, and he comes and clobbers him then. I can quite understand why he had to lose the costume, but I'll go with it. It made it cool to have Barry punch Grodd.
It made for a better cover, too.
Yeah, that's true.
Squeezing the costume.
The last page, I think they got to the end. They're like, oh, we're a page short. Because the last page is kind of dumb. He's dragging Grodd back to Africa, to Gorilla City. And Grodd just jumps out of his wake into the ocean. He has to go down in the ocean and get him and still take him back to jail. That doesn't have anything to do with any of the rest of the story in my mind. To me, this was them had to stretch out the story one more page. I don't know if you had that same feeling.
Yeah, I did. And I understand they weren't written in the Marvel style for these type of comics. But it felt like something else was going on in the story, and then they had to put word balloons to try to explain it, because he's like, oh, he broke free, oh, he's swimming down, and then Barry just goes and gets him. What's interesting, and I made a note about this, is I did look at this one on DC Infinite, and the last page is slightly different. It doesn't end with that Solovar Barry panel. DC Infinite one has a slightly different one. I think he's talking to Iris in the end or something else instead of that editor's note down there. I don't know why there's a different one, but I agree that that last page was strange, that Grodd basically just wanted to take a swim.
I have the original issue. I'm going to grab it right now. So I just pulled Flash number 172 out of my collection, the original issue. And this is what you're talking about. The last page was cut out of this issue. It's one of those half pages with an ad on the bottom part. There is a panel of Flash talking to Solovar, but that is transposed to the bottom right of the last page of the story here. And then there are two panels of Flash talking to Iris at the end. So I will scan the original last two pages. They definitely reformulated this whole last page. And I will put that in the galleries for people to look at, because that's pretty neat. I still don't understand why that water scene has to happen, but it is interesting. That's the kind of thing you can imagine Bob Rozakis with an X-Acto knife in the production room, 1976, doing that. Probably Nelson Bridwell did it at this time. He was Julie's assistant. Good catch, man. Good catch.
Thanks.
All right. Anything else on this story before we move on to our last one?
I want to reiterate what you said about the math. I love that where there's actually comic book math equations in the air above blurry. And you look at it and, you know, it's like trying to say Johnny Quick's speed formula, however you say it.
Right.
I love that. And I love whenever there's a chalkboard with stuff on there like that too. So there were a couple of editor's notes, like you said, about teaching stuff. The one about the Flash travels so fast, he's like a skimming shell over the water.
Love that.
And there was another one earlier that talked about him being so fast that he can see things that are going, you know, he can adjust his senses that way too. And the only other thing I wanted to mention was Iris made him 3-minute eggs in 3 seconds. And I don't think you should eat them, Barry.
All right, let's move on to our last story. It's called The Gorilla Boss of Gotham City, 12 pages, written by David Vern Reed and penciled by Lou Schwartz and inked by Stan Kay. As I mentioned, from Batman 75, 1953. This one has been reprinted a couple times. It was reprinted in Batman Annual number 3 from 1962, as well as the hardcover edition of those annuals. And that is an awesome book. Anybody has those? It was a part of the DC Classics Comics Library. There are two hardcovers that reprint all the Batman annuals from the 60s, which have all stories from the 50s and 40s. Fantastic book. And it is also in the Batman Golden Age Omnibus number 8. Amazingly, despite the enormous amount of Batman stuff on DC Universe Infinite, this individual issue is not there, and I could not find a collection that had this story in it. So, you know, sorry, gang, I'll try to include a lot of scans because this was a fun one. So take it away, John.
George Dyke, a big-time gangster who ignored any loot that was under $1,000 because he's that big time, is executed in the gas chamber. His body is taken to Doc Willard, a renegade scientist. The doctor transplants Dyke's brain into the body of a gorilla in hopes of reviving Dyke. The gorilla, by the way, is gigantic, so I hope the brain fits. The operation is a success. Dyke cannot speak, but he can write, and he informs Willard that when he has stolen $1 million, he wants the doc to retransplant his brain into the body of Batman. The doc is terrified, but has no choice but to obey the gorilla boss. Throughout the story, the doctor's really scared of the idea of doing that to Batman, but not scared of the idea, apparently, of doing this to George. Dyke then begins a crime spree using the gorilla's body. Batman and Robin try to stop him, not knowing there's a human brain in the body. They are surprised at how smart the gorilla seems. In fact, Dyke makes sure not to damage Batman's body, since we know he's saving him for a more horrible fate. But he also leaves a curious clue. He knocks off an armored car and only steals the $1,000 bills, leaving the lower denominations behind. Batman's going to figure that out. He's a detective. Batman starts to suspect that this is no mere trained animal. There must be a human mind behind the action somehow, but Dyke is finally able to accumulate over $1 million and then captures Batman and orders the doctor to switch their brains. We cut, pun intended, to the doc after the operation. He claims it's been a success, but the gorilla, presumably with Batman's brain, has escaped with Batman's body, Fay Wray style, presumably with Dyke's brain. The gorilla boss goes all King Kong, climbing to the top of a skyscraper. Robin is able to grab Batman's limp body, but the gorilla falls to his death. Is this the end of the Caped Crusader? No. Turns out Batman was able to stop the operation and then switch places with the doctor. Dyke had awakened early and thought the operation had been unsuccessful. That's why he grabbed Batman with the intent of killing him at least. Fortunately, Doc Willard had been driven mad by the experience, ensuring that there were no further brain transplants, or will there? The end.
So what are your first thoughts on this one, John?
Okay, again, another crazy story, but I guess that's kind of the theme. Two stories from the 50s. And one from the 60s. And so much, as I said earlier, happens in so few pages, but just so charming. Brain surgery transplants that just happen quickly. Literally, he walks in and he's like, okay, I'm done. And one of my favorite parts, and I know this is going to be a favorite of yours, is Batman gets to disguise himself as the doctor, but remaining in his Batman costume underneath the rubber mask.
That's always one of my favorites. I agree. This was a super fun story. The Batman stories of this time, this is right before they start getting all science fiction-y and really weird. Sort of late golden age Batman stories are all a lot of fun with lots of stuff going on. This one's out there. We start off with this giant gorilla on the splash page. I mean, he's 1, 2, 3 stories tall at least.
Absolutely.
He's throwing chains off and police officers are falling. But we start off the story. It's pretty grim. It's raining. You got all these witnesses going into the prison to witness the execution of this gangster, George Dyke. bike. He's in the gas chamber, and then there's a skull and crossbones. I'm like, wow, this is pre-code. That I thought was interesting. I do like they always set clues in the first two panels after the execution. Batman and Robin are in the Batcave. They've got their file cabinet. Robin's got a file card for George Dyke. His specialty is crimes of violence. His trademark steals big denomination bills only, right on the index card. I love that. I just love that Batman's got an index card for all these mob bosses.
I love it too.
Good writing. That's setting the stage for us to understand, for Batman to be able to figure it out later, because this guy's got to tell. So then we get the mad scientist, and he's looking really crazed in the bottom part of this page. They've got the gorilla sort of sitting in a cage, drugged out. They've got the brain in a big vat. And then you see this image of the doctor, he's sweating, and there's like gas containers and scissors and gloves and stuff all around, getting at the complexity, so to speak, of this brain transplant. Even though the gorilla is way too big, I like that he can write. He couldn't speak. He can't make the same sounds. If you take the comic book science of being able to transplant a brain into a gorilla, okay, then how is he going to communicate? Well, he's got to write it out. Okay.
And he writes in cursive, and he's got good cursive handwriting too, said the fifth and sixth grade teacher.
Do you still teach cursive at all?
We don't teach cursive, but we do actually have it as something that the kids can work on because, in all honesty, we try not to have everything be on computers, on Chromebooks, but also they need to read cursive and they need to be able to sign their name. So their name tags are all in cursive, done by yours truly, because I learned in third grade.
My oldest is 31 now, and my youngest is 23. They can't read or write cursive. Their signatures are just whatever they came up with over the years. They had a little bit of it in like fourth grade or whatever it was, but they never use it because then they just typed everything. Back to the story. Then the boss goes on his crime spree. It's pretty funny. For as gigantic as the gorilla is, he's pretty spry. He evades Batman and Robin a couple times. So I have a question for you. Why do you think the doctor has such qualms? He's so nervous about transplanting the brain a second time into Batman's brain. Is it because it was scientifically interesting to do it into a gorilla, but he doesn't want to do it into a human? I find it strange that he'd have such humanitarian qualms. Is he just afraid of Boss Dyke being in Batman's superb athletic body? Why is he so worked up about this?
I was just as puzzled about that one. It's like he has no problem taking Boss Dyke and putting him in the gorilla, but then it was like, oh no, don't ask me to do that. And I thought, oh, that sounds really terrible. But clearly he's a criminal doctor, and so he's not afraid to do nasty stuff. But I guess I'd probably go with what you just said. He doesn't want the evil brain of Boss Dyke in the perfect human body specimen of Batman.
Because maybe he figures then his usefulness is over and he'd be taken out by the boss Batman guy.
He's capable of performing these brain surgeries in like 30 minutes or less. So he probably should be kept around just in case.
Yeah, you never know. So we get to page 7. I think my favorite panel is Batman just kicking back in Commissioner Gordon's office.
Yes.
The body language is great, even though the figures are really tiny. You got Commissioner Gordon sitting on the edge of the desk, Batman in his chair, leaning back on two legs with his feet up on the desk. I love that. He's just kicking back. They're brainstorming about what could be going on. I just think that's really cool.
I noticed that too when I was rereading it last night. I'm used to the Adam West Batman being so stiff and stuff like that. And I'm like, why would Batman be sitting with his legs on his desk?
Kicking back, chatting with a colleague. I just think that's terrific. So then we get action with the gorilla. He steals more money out of the bank. You see the gorilla with a big bag of money, but it says $1,000 on it, meaning he's only taking the bills with $1,000. And the guards are, look, left all these fives and tens and twenties. What's going on? And Batman, finger on the chin. No ordinary animal could be trained to do the things this ape has done, Robin. We must learn this creature's secret before it's too late. There's an Adam West quote right there.
Yeah, exactly.
The last robbery, he steals the rest of his money and the ape captures Batman. But at the top of page, I guess it's page 9, the gorilla escapes through the sewer. Think about how big manhole covers it. There's no way. They do show that he's made the sewer hole bigger by crashing into it. Now, we do know from Batman Family Reunion that the Gotham City sewers are big enough for like Man-Bat to fly around in. So they have these giant sewers down there. So I guess that's why he picked it.
And he's a gorilla. He's not Mole Man, or he doesn't have like a drill or something like that. So it's kind of weird that he's going down. But yeah, they definitely show the distressed sewer manhole.
So he gets back to the doctor and his thugs make sure the doctor does it. The gorilla escape. He goes full King Kong, climbing to the top of the building. Robin saves the limp Batman body, but the gorilla falls to his death. And we're like, uh-oh, are you going to be able to salvage Batman's brain and put it back in his body? But no, of course, the Caped Crusader rips off the plastic mask as he does so often in the Bronze Age. He's in the doctor's outfit. The doctor was in a spare Batman outfit that he had, a miniature size one in his utility belt.
Love it.
That's so Batman doesn't have to take his outfit off ever. Then this last page, there are lots of words, as many of these things are. We find out that, quote, fortunately, the guy has gone mad. There won't be any more transplants in the future, which is probably a good thing. But we know that that's not true because the Ultra Humanite comes along later and takes care of that. And that, I think, is the end of the story. Any last thoughts on this?
I have a couple. So after the first Superman story, and I looked up King Krypton, then the second Flash story, of course, Grodd has a bunch of appearances. But I did a little research, and both Doc Willard and George Boss Dyke's brain show up in three issues of World's Finest, written by Bob Haney, 251, 252, and 254. I own one of those three. I can't say I ever read this, or if I do, I don't remember the whisper, the whole thing. Sinestro gets involved in 254. They're talking about Dyke's brain. Dyke's brain has its own little fandom Wikipedia page. I'm surprised that that character hasn't come back again, but I was more surprised that this was happening in the Dollar Comics. Yet another thread that could be taken up by somebody else if they needed to. The only other thing that I wrote down was there's a house ad for the specials,
yes,
which is perfect for this show. And it does, of course, do the DC Superstars number 10. It's got the Three Musketeers on there. That's pretty cool. Super Team Family's on there. I love the house ads. You had mentioned the Hostess ad. I was a fan of the Hostess fruit pie, not only like eating them, but I was a fan of the Hostess ads when I was a young comic fan.
Sure.
I thought it was part of the story because I was 7 or 8 years old. I love the fashion ads. This is why, as much as I love DC Infinite, nothing is the same as holding on to a comic that you bought twice over the course of 50 years. The last thing was the 1977 DC calendar ad. Mm-hmm. And then finally, the very last page had the superhero stick-ons. These mm-hmm. were all things that then I wish I had. Now, if I had, they'd be in a box behind me here and I wouldn't know where they were anyways. I was super impressed by you finding that issue of Flash as fast as you did. This was a hoot. This was so much fun. It's just a blast.
That's
Thank
awesome.
You for letting me read it.
Yeah, it was great. This was one of the ones early on that I knew I wanted to get to. I hadn't had anybody volunteer to do this one. Martin did for when his turn comes up again. It's one of the ones he listed, the other one, the first one from the earlier part of the DC Special line. But no one had asked about this one until you came along. I'm like, oh, well, let's get you in as soon as possible because I wanted to reread this one myself. I guess we don't even have to ask you whether this lived up to its special billing.
Oh, it absolutely, absolutely did. I think at the time, as a kid, I was probably more confused because I didn't really know the reprints versus the contemporary comics. If I could have gotten a special containing new gorilla stories, that would have been great. But this was so much fun then. And I think in hindsight, it's even more fun now.
I just want to thank you again, John, for joining me. Can you tell our listeners how they might be able to get in touch with you, where they might be able to find you, what other podcasts you might be appearing on, either right before this one comes out or right after?
Yeah, this is my first official comic book podcast, but I will be recording with Shag, hopefully. And that one apparently will be coming out before this one. I have just had a blast. I post a lot on Facebook. I actually post on Facebook, and my brother-in-law said to me that I use it like an online photo album, and I do. So I'm on Facebook under my first and last name, John Stibe. I post about my life, but I also post a bunch of stuff about comics. I post what I read each week because I try to read a comic a day, and I post what I read each week in something called the Spinner Rack, which is not a real spinner rack because I wish I had one of those, but it's also my way of keeping track of what I read. So maybe I'm posting it just for myself. I'm on Instagram, Twitter, and Blue Sky as JJ Carl ST at those things, which sounds confusing, but back in the old AOL days, you couldn't use your real name. So it's a mashup. I actually have two middle names. So it's a mashup of like my initials and one of my middle names and the start of my last name, which was really cool back then, kind of like in the 70s when it was cool to have a CB radio handle. in the 90s, we had our AOL names because I've had people be like, why JJ Carl ST? And I was like, that's how we did it.
That's awesome.
I'm out there and I'll be commenting on this episode and other episodes on the Fire and Water Network because I am just a huge fan of the shows, huge fan of comics and all the stuff that you guys are doing. So thank you for letting me be part of this.
Well, thank you again, John. It was great to meet you and great to podcast with you. You're a natural. You did a great job. So now I'm going to play a short promo or two. And when I return, you will hear the final installment of Catch You Later Calculator with Sean M. Myers, plus my next episode announcement and listener feedback. So stay tuned.
Grab your bat microphone. It's time to start the show.
Welcome to the Bat Pod, a Batman comic book discussion podcast.
What are you doing? That's my line.
I'm starting the show. I was waiting on you. We're starting the show.
I'm the one that says that. You're my new co-host, where we talk about back issues of Batman, could be in Detective Comics, World Finest.
Could we do some Shadow of the Bat and maybe some Nightwing, maybe some Batgirl?
Absolutely.
Can we also define where my co-hosting parameters start and end? I can't start the show, but I can definitely co-host it.
Well, maybe we'll let you start the show.
Okay, at least I get to pick one of the books we're covering on each episode and you can pick the other?
Absolutely.
Can I close out the show? Can I bring friends? Will there be snacks?
What is your favorite bat snack?
Cucumber sandwiches.
Join Bill Beer and J. David Weider every 2 weeks on the Bat Pod. You can find us on your favorite podcast app.
Grab your headphones, listen up. You know you love it. Drop the facade. Like the Dark Knight Detective, they've got some perspective. They're a pure crime-fighting collective. It's the Bat Pod.
Welcome back. Despite some technical difficulties I just had, it's now time for another special conversation with my Bat brother, Sean M. Myers. We are reviewing Bob Ruzakis' 1976 storyline from the back pages of Detective Comics in the final segment of...
Catch you later, Calculator! And this month we are covering Detective 468, the final chapter of the Calculator saga, starring Batman and some of the Justice League. It's Detective Comics 468. Cover dated March-April 1977, on sale date of December 28th, 1976, and the editor is Julius Schwartz. And yes, you can read this story on the DC Universe Infinite app.
All right, Sean, so tell me what you think of this cover.
So I'm going to make a lot of people really mad. First of all, I like the cover. It's very dynamic. You have a calculator and he's expertly posed. You get a great view of his outfit. Now you can decide whether that's good or bad, but it is, it's laid out fantastically well. The stuff coming out of it, the top doesn't even look really, really goofy. It's kind of like a claw, like the claw is our master coming for like Batman and he's leaping up. You have all of the heroes laying down, which is fantastic. Like they're all defeated. My only thing, and I know, like I've said this before, please don't come for me, Rob. I'm not a big Aparo fan, especially when you flip the page and then you get the beautiful artwork. I don't not like Jim Aparo, not like a Don Heck. He's not a Heckism. I do like the cover. I just wish it was Marshall Rogers doing it.
Well, I love this cover. I think it's great. I have a copy of this displayed on my comic book room because I like this cover so much. I am holding the copy I got when I was a kid for 30 cents in 1976. I agree with you that the crane coming out of the calculator's head looks way less goofy than it does in any of the other stories.
Yeah.
Somehow he did it. It looks more metallic. It looks like it's exploding out of his headpiece. Definitely less goofy. He is twisted a little funny so you can see his calculator, but that's because that's what they had to do. The editors always wanted to see the chest insignias on the covers.
In terms of him twisting, I will give Jim Aparo super props because you can see his calf through the boot. That's fantastic.
The calculator is ripped. The heroes lying on the ground, defeated, looks fantastic. I just love this. I remember being very excited when I first got this because I'd been waiting for this comic to come out because having followed this and I'd reread them, I was like, wow, what's the calculator's story? Surely we're going to get the answers to all our questions now, right?
No doubt.
Surely we're going to get the answers to all our questions. All right, let's jump into the story.
Okay, the title is The Battle of the Thinking Machines. It's 17 pages, written by Bob Ruzakis, penciled by Marshall Rogers, inked by Terry Austin, and it is reprinted in The Legends of the Dark Knight Marshall Rogers hardcover from 2012. And one great thing about this story, it features Batman and Green Arrow and Atom and Hawkman and Black Canary and Elongated Man, and a mention of The Flash.
Aquaman's in there too, briefly.
Oh, that's right. Yeah, and Aquaman. So we open in media res as the calculator is trying to steal the history of Gotham City, a 1624 archaeological find of the $24 worth of trinkets the settlers used to buy Gotham City from the Native Americans. Despite his tricks, Batman is able to defeat the computerized criminal, but not before he pushes his special button. Batman has a brief respite for coffee in the penthouse and to take an annoying call from fellow business tycoon Morgan Edge before the special JLA meeting he has called to discuss the calculator. We get a mini Rosakis recap to fill in readers of the last 5 months of detective backup stories. But before the heroes can do anything, they learn that the numerical nemesis has already escaped. In a nice bit of continuity, the calculator has moved on to Central City to take on the Flash. But the Flash is on Earth 2 at the moment, as Julius Schwartz lets us know in a very helpful caption. So the six heroes beam down to Central City, where we get some terrific Marshall Rogers action of the JLA members, tripping over themselves as the calculator laughs at their mishaps. They can't even touch him. The Atom even tries switching to Ray Palmer to take him down, but that doesn't work either. Defeated, the heroes resume their daily lives. Bruce Wayne is met by Morgan Edge, but barely listens to him. But when Morgan says, "I want to get you to see things my way," Bruce has a brainstorm. He ditches Edge and goes back into action as the Batman. Back in the still flashless Central City, the calculator reads of a time capsule to be launched into space that day, which somehow is most valuable today. He goes to Star Labs to steal it, but finds Batman there instead of Flash. Batman seems to be acting very un-Batman-like by trying to use techniques he know will not work against the mathematical menace. But at the same time, he is taunting him with phrases like throw you in jail, get you locked up, put you behind bars. The calculator finally takes the bait and generates a giant jail cell and launches it towards the Caped Crusader. But Batman is prepared. He clicks a button on his utility belt and the floor spins around 180 degrees so that the calculator is trapped in his own jail cell. This short circuits all of the gadgets, and the calculator is finally defeated for good. And of course, we get a great Rosakis recap where Batman explains all of this to his Justice League pals, while also annoying Morgan Edge. The end. Now, before I ask Paul what he thought of the story, I want to let you guys know, Paul wrote that description, and he did a fantastic job of coming up with the alliterative nicknames for the calculator.
That's a lot of work, Ellie.
I am glad for this show, if only because of those names. Great job, Paul.
This is a great conclusion. We don't really get much intelligence about the calculator. We'll talk about that at the end. But as a story, it's a terrific story. It's a lot of fun. I love it. The art is fantastic. Let's talk about the general storyline first. What are your thoughts there first?
Of course, it's easy to say this because all of the other ones were just six-page yep. records. So obviously, this story has more room. All throughout the earlier segments, we said the story was okay, but the art really carries it through. And don't get me wrong, like the art is phenomenal here. But this story is really, really good. And the nice thing is, you probably really could not have read any of the earlier stories and still get a gist of what's going on. If you've read the earlier ones, great. But I don't want to say necessarily it stands on its own, but
this story has a beginning, a middle, and an end. No question exactly. about it. All right, let's break it up. You got this first part, you got the splash page and the fight sequence on pages 2 to 5, I thought were excellent. Despite the figures, I think, being a little small on the splash page, there's a lot of text in that computerized text. The Batman figure's a little small. The calculator figure's a little small. You get a great little inset of the other heroes showing that they're the guest stars in this issue. But you get a lot of great Marshall Rogers architecture.
Yeah. It's so funny. Like, it never even dawned on me up until I learned that he was an architectural student. It never even dawned on me. Obviously, his buildings are phenomenal. So why didn't it jump in my head that, you know what? I wonder if he was an architectural student. I guess, you know, Metropolis or even Central City, I guess they're all famous cities in DC. But yeah, if you're going to put an architectural student draw, Gotham City is the place to do it.
This page is great. You've got Batman swinging at the top on his rope, and his rope sort of coils around, goes off the page, and comes back around above him as the sort of the loose end of his rope.
I'm sorry. I literally just noticed right now that in Batman's cape, it says Batman.
That's great.
I never even noticed that before. Oh my God. I'm sorry.
That's awesome. We should say that. There's no Batman logo, but in his cape, he's dialed in the word Batman, which is pretty neat. Because all the other text on the page, other than the calculator's dialogue, is in that sort of computer font. Batman swinging in on his rope. And in a great continuity bit, Calculator has generated a tomahawk and shoots it at Batman. And on the next page, the tomahawk actually cuts Batman's bat rope, which is pretty cool. Yeah. I always thought that was excellent. At the bottom left of this page, you got the great little inset of the other five heroes. You got the Black Canary. She's cracking her knuckles, ready to give the Calculator what for. And the Hawkman and the strange-looking mask that he's got with the long pointy things at the bottom, the way Marshall Rogers draws him. I don't know. I just love that little inset. It's just a great splash page. I just think it's terrific.
When the tomahawk slices his
Yeah, that's in the top of the next page.
And then he Krav Magraws his way over to the derrick or the crane or whatever.
Yeah. These two pages are fantastic sequence of Batman acrobatics by Marshall Rogers. It's really terrific. I like how he says, observe, I'm going to compute your chances of defeating me with any of your bat weapons, and then there's a little computer, zero. He generates a fan out of his head to blow the Batman gas away.
But before that, when Batman is throwing the batarang, just the way the batarang is on the page, and then the way Calculator grabs it and crunches it, it reminds me of back in Batman Family when Robin had his batarang and it like folded up.
I don't know if you remember that page.
It always reminded me of that. But also, I love the way the little hand out of Calculator's head just like tosses it away, flips it away.
Get rid of this little annoyance. Great Batman shot all along. Batman tries to gas him, and he does all these different things to try to defeat the Calculator. And Calculator's putting up a good fight. He generates a foot out of his head to kick Batman in the head. Like, ouch, that looks like it hurts. And he says, I have to get back to the old reliable acrobatics, pun intended, to defeat them. And there's a great headshot of Batman top of the page five. His cowl is really dark. That's very Marshall Rogers, Terry Austin-esque there. That's really terrific. He says, he's staying one move ahead of me. And he says, nothing of mine works, so I have to put him out of action with his own weapon. That's very foreshadowing to the way that he actually does defeat him at the end.
Yep.
Which is really good. Somehow he gets a trampoline to send Batman away, but Batman picks up the trampoline and throws it at the Calculator just before the Calculator hits a special button. That's sort of segment one. So then it's the next morning or that morning, and you get Batman lounging around in the penthouse. This scene is fantastic. Alfred's bringing him some tea.
Look at all of those books.
A lot of books in his study. He's looking out the window. He's still in his bat suit, but this is what I love. His cowl is off. And his gloves are off. This is another pet peeve of mine. Why these heroes go around their own houses or the JLS satellite even with their gloves on. I get out in the field, right? You don't want to leave your fingerprints around, your secret identities, whatever. But when you're lounging around your house.
The first thing you do when you come home from work is you kick off your shoes.
Yes.
If you have to wear a tie, you loosen your tie. You do all of that.
Exactly. So his cowl is like his tie. He takes it off, takes his gloves off. He's hanging out. He's talking to Morgan Edge on the phone. This little sort of through line with Morgan Edge is pretty funny. Apparently, Morgan Edge is trying to sell Galaxy Paperbacks, a media mergers and acquisitions / divestiture. Not that we know anything about that these days, right?
Mass market paperbacks, rest in peace.
So Morgan Edge is trying to sell the money-losing Galaxy Paperbacks. Apparently, Bruce owns 6% of Galaxy Communications. Who knew, right? So he needs Bruce's vote. But Bruce keeps pushing him off because he's called this emergency meeting of the JLA to talk about the Calculator, which is great. They should have done this a while ago, right? But none of them cared enough about what the other problems were until Batman said, wait a minute, guys, we should talk about this.
The interesting thing about this scene with Morgan Edge is, do you know that canonically, Bob Rozakis created Slash Fiction?
Okay. I did not. So tell me more.
I don't have these issues. I have to read them on the app. But one of the great things about reading it is you can zoom in on the pictures. And there is a picture on Morgan Edge's desk of Clark. It's like a headshot. And it says, Love Clarky.
I didn't notice that.
I don't know.
I saw that it was Clark, but I never noticed the Love Clarky before. That is too funny. The fact that it says Love Clarky is classic.
And specialers, this is not a bit. No, this is absolutely true. Like, in fact, this should be, instead of whatever real issue you talked about like 20 minutes ago, no, this should be the picture that goes on to social media of, no, I'm just kidding. Forget gorillas, it's Clarky.
That is great, because I'm looking at the actual comic, and you really have to squint.
Yeah.
And I have to take my glasses off in order to even see this. I can't even read Clarky. I just think it says Love Clark.
That's because I have these digest-trained eyes.
Yeah, that must be it. Oh, Okay, so then we go up to the satellite. Batman's chairing this meeting. And of course, my favorite thing, the Atom sitting in his little tiny chair. Yeah. I love that. I love his little floating chair. Green Arrow doesn't want to sit down. He's standing up. Aquaman's on monitor duty. So there's Aquaman cameoing in this. And they get the notice that the calculator has showed up in Central City. The Flash isn't there. We got to go down. And of course, Aquaman can't go with them because he's on monitor duty.
Paul, if you were in the JLA satellite, would you have an idea where the transporter controls are? Like, do you know like where you would go to find that?
I have a note on that too. Aquaman standing in underneath the transporter panel, which is like this big oval thing. It says transport control underneath it. And I don't know whether that's Marshall Rogers' homage to the Batman 66 show.
That's what I almost kind of, yeah.
Or what? I'm not sure that really says it there, or whether that's just him putting that on there. He does like that sort of graphic design element. We've seen that before from him. So then we get a great scene. Why don't you talk us through the next scene where they're all trying to defeat the calculator?
So this is super cool. The calculator is basically waiting there because he calculated that they would come. In a cross promotion, he says, right on time, just as I calculated. The so-called world's greatest superheroes, available in daily newspapers. If your newspaper isn't carrying one, please call the editor and request it. So then, coming up is actually probably one of the only complaints art-wise that I have. All of the heroes are like gonna attack the calculator, and you have Green Arrow, and he has, of course, the boxing glove arrow, and it's going right to calculator, and you see it veer off course, and it's gonna hit Ralph. And then the next page, you see it hit his head. Black Canary gives her canary cry, and then you kind of see like going towards the calculator, and then it veers off course and hits the heroes. Then you have almost like a mini splash page where it's Batman in the middle, and then all of the heroes are like going into action against the calculator.
Great. I love that little page, that panel.
Now, my complaint is on the next page, so it's like a half page panel kind of with inset panels. You have calculator and he's standing there laughing, and that part is great. And then you have these little like inset panels, but the panels are kind of like out of order. It's not up and down, and it's not left and right in tiers. It is kind of not a mosaic, but they're not in order because you have Batman and he's going out for the calculator. Then below that, you have Black Canary jumping, but then Black Canary jumps into Elongated Man, and then Green Arrow's bow snaps from a boomerang. But then on the other side, you have Elongated Man going after Calculator. Then you see Green Arrow's 8-ball. Then you see Black Canary bouncing off of the Calculator. Then you see the Batarang going behind the Calculator. And then you see Green Arrow's 8-ball arrow hitting Batman's arm. So it's kind of like all out of order.
It's jumbled up. I kind of inferred that they were kind of all taking place at the same time. I agree it doesn't flow. It's not sequential, but it's sort of chaotic. Maybe that's what he was going for, is to convey the sense of chaos. And you know, all these different things are happening, but it's chaos. That's the only thing. I agree with you. It doesn't flow, but it's still very cool. You have to admit.
Because each panel is its separate panel. I almost wonder if some of these were like overlapping and underlapping. Maybe I would have gotten that idea more. Literally, that is the one complaint, the one art complaint I have in this issue. So
then you get the calculator describing dramatic announcement heroes on the next page. No matter how hard you try, none of you can ever capture me again. We can talk about it now. We can talk about it later. How does this work? Where did he get this technology? No idea. Never addressed.
And don't get me wrong, ambiguity can be great. Like, what's in the briefcase in Pulp Fiction? Oh, I don't know. Is it his soul? Is it? So that's kind of like fine and cool. But I kind of think in a superhero story like this, maybe he had an answer and he was going to do another story, but
it could have been like, we could get half a page or a couple of panels of him finding alien computer that crashed, right? Yeah. That had some, you know what I mean? Like a Green Lantern scene where the alien computer crashes. You're the most despicable person. We're going to give this to you and go calculate crimes. It wouldn't be that hard. But the fact that it's just totally ignored just cracks me up. When I was a kid, I loved this. That's why we're doing this. And Sean is indulging me, right? But I remember thinking, well, it's got to come back. And they've got to tell us more about it eventually, right? No. We do get the calculator does come back in that Atom and Airwave story, which we'll talk about briefly later. But that's it. We never really figure it out. And so that, as an adult, that's unsatisfying. But what are you going to do? One of the things Max and I talked about in the very first episode of the show was the machine that the Sportsmaster and Huntress used to gather all the heroes and villains together for the baseball game. Never seen before or since, right? And no explanation.
Meanwhile,
on that.
You could sell that to a city as a transportation option and make millions of dollars.
Right. All kinds of stuff, right? The common denominator in those two things, our pal and bad cousin, Bob Rozakis. We love you, Bob. It's like, hey, who cares? Let's get going. Let's get going with the action. So that's it.
Wait, actually, we're going to back up just a little. Hawkman's coming after Calculator. Calculator makes him crash. And I love this sound effect where it says crash and the crash letters are like crumbled and into each other. I guess I had seen it before in the issue, but that made me go back and look at all of the different sound effect words.
He's fantastic at
sound effect. It is phenomenal. I love that.
The white space between the panels are cracked. Like Hawkman is crashed into that. It's fantastic.
That is just fantastic.
Then the Atom gets the idea. He gets big. He turns into Ray Palmer. I guess he was the least known, so nobody knew who the heck Ray Palmer is. So, okay. And he says, oh, it's about time one of you tried this trick. And that doesn't work, though. The heroes are all, I guess Hawkman has knocked them all out. They're all lying on the ground, and the Calculator just kind of wanders away. Time lapse, just to let us know.
This time lapse, I'm such a fool. I thought, I bet this time lapse is a flashback to how Calculator got his powers. I've read this story, I don't know, 6 or 7 times, I guess, in my life. But man, I guess I just always got bamboozled thinking, there has to be an explanation. I bet this is it. We're going to get a flashback. We don't get a flashback.
No flashback. Instead, we get Morgan Edge with his tiny cigarette and a stick waiting to basically hijack Bruce Wayne as Bruce comes into the building. And he brings a lobster flown in from his personal lobster bed. Thinking he's going to impress Bruce.
I will not need a scientific explanation for his personal lobster bed. That I accept.
And he's like, look at this. He opens up the lid. There's a lobster under there. It's still hot. And Bruce is like, they've been getting on the elevator, going up. That's when it's not written by Jack C. Comment Harris. It's written by Bob Rozakis, where he says, I just wanted to make things easy so you can see things my way. And that's when Bruce has the brainstorm and he shuts the elevator doors and Morgan Edge is banging on the doors like, wait a minute. I can't get away. I love this. It doesn't take up a lot of panels or pages of the story. It's a little bit at the beginning, a little bit here in the middle, and a little bit at the end. But it's a very nice little touch by Bob to sort of bring in the broader DC universe. Got Morgan Edge, got some of Bruce Wayne personal life. You can talk about it. Yeah, this comment, it's a little bit of a stretch, whatever. But, you know, Batman's back of his head, you know, back of his brain has been working on this. And this just gave him a little inspiration. So I thought this little part with Morgan Edge is brilliant. I
liked it. Yeah, I agree. I think it's fantastic.
You see, Batman can't stop the Calculator, neither can Bruce Wayne, but I know who can beat him and how. And then you get the patented Julie Schwartz.
Yeah.
Yes, with a little hand. And how about you, reader?
The
Carmine Infantino fingers, which you know that he was instructed to use. Have you figured out the one way to stop the computer of crime? I like my names better than the computer. So then I guess has to be some more time lapse because then we get a image of the Calculator reading the newspaper.
The Central City Picture News.
The Picture News, which is where Iris works.
Yeah. Very
nice little tie in here. You get the Calculator reading it. The Central City branch of Star Labs reports that all systems are go for the launch of its unique time capsule. It makes it super complicated. It's going to be launched in through a time warp.
I know.
Instead of into space, it's the time warp is only open for the next 10 seconds. It's like, man, why did we have to put that in there? But it's very cool. As a kid, I'd be like, whoa. And he says, it won't be open until the long time away time of 1996. Sorry, two old guys laughing away here. And he still thinks he's going to get the Flash and doesn't know the Flash isn't around.
Oh, wait a minute. So specialers, you might not know, but I hate math and I'm not good at math. When was this story published?
1976.
76. So 96.
It would have been 20 years of a
20. Oh,
which isn't that long of a time capsule, to be honest with you. They should have said 2076 or 2026 for 50 years. That would have been.
Well, that's what I'm going to say, right? It's longer between when the time capsule is opened and when we are recording today,
right. Then
when the time
years.
Capsule is right. Did I do that math right?
You did that math correctly.
Okay, that's good. Right. Okay.
So then the Calculator shows us a new power. Apparently he now has the power of Mr. Freeze or Captain Cold.
That's a great panel. Yeah.
Police cars see him and he just shoots. Shoosh. ice breath out of his forehead and freezes the police car. And he says, "You freeze in this blizzard, carefully calculated to cover my tracks." Again, he did not calculate the probability of a spot blizzard freezing two police officers. He made it happen. So then you get the final scene, and this is some great art in this scene where you've got the calculator show up, Batman swings in, he's got like a crane coming out of his head so that he can get the time capsule, and it's a different kind of crane than what's on the cover, but it's inspired by that, right? It's got a hook to pick up the time capsule, yeah, I guess.
This is more like a construction crane.
Right, as opposed to a gaming pick the claw animal out of the claw, right. And this is great, because you know something's going on, because Batman's trying things he's already tried. He throws a batarang at him, he throws the smoke bombs at him, and he keeps talking about behind bars and throw you in jail. And then the second to last page is a cool page, but I do want to talk about the physics of this a little bit, because he taunts him until the calculator generates a jail cell out of his head and launches it in the air across the room at Batman. And Batman touches his utility belt, and all of a sudden the floor spins around like a giant record player, and the calculator gets trapped by his own jails. Very clever. Although that thing's got to be spinning pretty mighty fast to get there before the jail cell does, and wouldn't they have all fallen over?
No.
No?
And I can tell you because, so I don't know if you remember, years ago at Disney, they had their nightclub district called Pleasure Island.
Yes.
And they had a dance club called Mannequins.
Okay.
And Mannequins had a revolving dance floor. And
I did not know this.
Loved that this was kind of like that. Now, truth be told, obviously, the dance floor like slowly rotated.
Right.
Like it didn't spin around, you know, like a carousel or that kind of thing. But I did love it because it reminded me of that. I went there like in 94 and 99, and it was a fantastic time. It's a fantastic club. But yeah, so it did remind me of that. The dance floor was set at the speed of 1, and then Batman just used his utility belt and put it up to like 9.
Yeah.
To spin them around. And again, another cool sound of that whir, like right in the middle.
The whir goes around in a circle. Yeah, very cool.
It's almost like the logo for Time Warp, yep. How you can see it twisting. Same thing with the whirl.
Listen, with all the other crazy stuff that happened in the storyline, this is the least of my concerns, right? It's clever. The point of it was, and this part holds up in story logic, Batman's figured out that he can't stop him from whatever crazy science, but that the calculator could stop himself.
Yeah.
And he taunts him into generating this jail cell thing. The jail cell lands on the calculator with these great panels of the calculator's chest machine going psh, 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 with all the buttons flying off. Just like right out of a cartoon. It's great.
Yeah, that looks great.
And so that part was terrific. So then we get the real Razakis roundup. Batman's again lounging in the study. All the other heroes have visited him there instead of the satellite because he's Batman. This time he's more professional. He's still at work, right, with his colleagues. So he leaves his mask and gloves on. This is where Batman explains it. And that's when he gets the phone call from an irate Morgan Edge, who's lost his vote, still saddled with the money-losing Galaxy paperbacks. And after he's mad, he says, "Wait a minute, I got an idea. We'll get some celebrities to write some books, and that'll boost sales. I know, I'll ask Batman to write a book, and that will boost sales." And Bruce hangs up, and then he starts laughing. And Black Canary's like, "I don't think I've ever seen Batman laugh before. That's kind of creepy."
I forget if it was in a comic book story or I heard it on a podcast or whatever. And Ryan, if this was you, let me know. There's some kind of line. The only thing more disconcerting than seeing Batman mad at you is seeing Batman laughing.
Yeah, they've done it a few times. This might have been the first, maybe not. I don't know. Because this wasn't that long after Batman became scary again, right? This is 1976. Yeah. It's only been 6 or 7 years since Neil Adams and Denny O'Neill came back. Time of change in the Batman mythos. And so he was scary again. He's still running around during daylight here. It's not Neil Adams changing everything tonight, but it's still that Batman. He's supposed to be a scary guy. It's a great joke to end the story with of Black Canary like, "Ooh, I don't know if I like to see him laughing like that." Hanging up the phone, he's laughing. It's a cute way to end the story. Good on you, Bob. And that's the end of the Calculator Saga. So, Sean, let us talk about some general questions. I've got a few general questions. What's the calculator's name? You asked me this 4 months ago. Do we know? No.
So his first name is Al. His middle initial is Q. So Al Q
Latour. Well, that's what Jason Moose said If you listen to the feedback of last month's episode, there was a great comment from Isamu telling us about how if you look at that Action Comics story where he's in court, how he was called Cal Q Latour.
Isamu, I'm very embarrassed because I haven't listened to the feedback.
No. Isamu was yanking our chain. That just came out today. You couldn't have listened to it.
Okay.
It just came out today. And Isamu was just yanking our chain. I'm like, really? And I went and I pulled it out and I looked at it and I'm like, I got you, Isamu.
Cal is better than Al.
Isamu had the same thought as you, but no, we don't get his name. But that's okay. No answer to where we get his stuff. No answer to the special button. No answer to the why of it all. Like this theme of sometimes he wanted to steal things when it's most valuable. Other times he was stealing other things, like stealing the World Series. What's that about? Don't care. The biggest thing, though, is he calculating things or is he making things happen, right? Yeah. So actually, in Mike's Amazing World, they actually have a little description of the calculator, because you know how they have little profiles. If you click on a character has enough appearances, they list all the appearances, and they have a little profile page on them. So the calculator's got a little one. And Mike says, a mathematical wizard, the calculator wears a computer terminal on his chest, capable of accurately predicting the actions of any superheroes, or even the Earth itself. He uses these calculations to plan his various crimes. The projector in his helmet, linked to his chest computer, is capable of creating an infinite variety of items by solidifying the dust in the air. The calculator has used this device to create giant fists, fans, cranes, etc. So there's a lot going on in that little description, but I still think that he's making stuff happen. So that's just me. How about you? Where do you land on that great issue?
It's kind of like, is it the first appearance of Lobo where he's wearing the spandex unitard? And yes. It doesn't really look like Lobo
at all.
The seat is there. And it's kind of like the first appearance of Ambush Bug is the DC Comics Presents with like the new Doom Patrol. And it's not really the Ambush Bug we know, but then he grew from that. Bob Razzak has planted great seeds that just never developed into a tree or a bush.
Yeah, somebody else could have come along if they wanted to keep using this version of the calculator and explained all this stuff. Like I said, I came up with the alien spaceship crashing with the computer, but nobody did. And instead, I don't know if it was Gail Simone or whoever in the Birds of Prey used the calculator in a much more current and technologically feasible way. He's the guy in the chair for the bad guys, the way Oracle's opposite number was a great, great character, great
I
use of the character.
Agree. Absolutely agree.
And so that was terrific. And that's the one that's a better character. And we mentioned it briefly, talked about Isamu, but there were three other brief appearances of the calculator in Action Comics in a three-part story versus the Atom and Airwave, who was sharing backup duties with the Atom in Action Comics at the time. And that was it for the calculator pre-crisis. Might have had a cameo or two. And then, of course, we just talked about the post-crisis. That's really it. What else do you have to say? Anything?
Great fun.
All right. I think we have calculated all the angles of this storyline at this point. I had a lot of fun. Sean, I want to thank you for indulging me. It gave us a chance to talk about this. This didn't really fit anywhere else. Nobody else would be goofy enough to talk about this goofy storyline with me, and just as goofy as I am. So thank you for indulging me. But listeners, the big news is next month, it is finally here. We are celebrating the 50th anniversary of the Daily Planet. As we kick off our monthly Planet segment, we will finally be getting to that. No more listening to me talk about the calculator. You're going to hear about, it's Bob Razzakis too. What are you going to do? One of our favorite things to talk about is Bob Razzakis. So we're going to keep talking about him and the monthly planets. I will talk to you next month, Sean. Thank you for this all doing.
See you next month, specialers.
I'm not done. Sean's taking off. I'm going to jump in to my next episode announcement and listener feedback. In May, I am excited to announce that my guest will be David Steele from the Earth 2 podcast. David is a great podcaster, and I'm really looking forward to recording with him live. David has chosen DC Special number 25, The Three Musketeers and Robin Hood. Why? Well, you'll have to listen and find out. And by the way, there's also a Viking Prince story in there, and we love those. And after 4 months of Catch Alligator Calculator with Sean M. Myers, next month we finally start the monthly Planet feature. We'll be covering the Daily Planet house ads from May of 1976, exactly 50 years later. So look forward to that episode on Sunday, May 3rd. Now let's get to your comments about our March episode with my guest, Matt Sirois, where we discuss DC Superstars number 13, The Wild and Wacky World of Sergio Aragonés. First up, Rob McCarthy said, I met Sergio twice. The first time, I gave him my mini comic. And a year later, he says, hey, Rob, loved your comic. That's cool, Rob. Thanks for sharing.
Bucky749, lads. Great show. Looking at Sergio's art style, it does seem to fit well in that Alice in Wonderland type world, where everybody was a little, quote, mad, pun intended. Here's a secret question for you. If you could meet Sergio and have him do a drawing for you, who would it be? Well, I'd probably get him to do Cain and Abel, Bucky, so thanks. My pal Dan Doherty said, another informative and interesting cast. Never knew that Sergio did DC, but always like his stuff in Mad. Can't wait until Superheroes vs. Gorillas. I happen to have that issue. Going to read it this week to get ready. Thanks, Dan. Hope you enjoyed the episode. The head honcho of Vintage Cinema Revisited and past guest Rob Kelly says, I love Aragonis' work. I always have. So fun that DC would turn over a whole issue just to him. I like Plop a lot, even though it had been canceled before I got to it. It was interesting that the horror hosts of all the characters were so often grafted into humor stories. Maybe if DC had done more superhero-centric stories in Plop, the book would have lasted longer? Maybe. It's a good thought, Rob. Marvel was never shy about goofing on their heroes, but DC always seemed more and more reticent. We'd have loved to see Sergio draw Aquaman. Yeah, I think that's probably it. They were a little more uptight. My Sergio story. One year in the late 90s, I went to the Mid-Ohio Comic-Con, where he was a guest. I was at the hotel and got on the elevator, one of those glass-enclosed ones that look out over the center of the building. On the elevator was Sergio. I knew what he looked like and recognized him immediately. A little kid and his parents got on, who was maybe 9 or 10, and was excited about the elevator ride. The kid started jumping up and down by the thrill of it all, and Sergio laughed and joined him, this hulking middle-aged man jumping up and down like a little kid. I thought to myself, yep, that tracks. That's a great story, Rob. Regarding the calculator, it would have been funny if Hawkman, after listing all the heroes the calculator had been fighting, said, and the next logical hero for him to take on is, of course, Red Tornado. Cue a lot of awkward silence from the other jailers. Great having Matt on the show. Thanks, Rob. Next up, Ada Bosnar said, excellent show. In my opinion, Aragonis can never get enough love and attention. The guy is a friggin' national, no scratch that, global treasure. And a great discussion, gentlemen. By the way, on the calculator story, you have the Star City Stars and the Gotham City Giants? Come on, man. Gotham City Goths were right there. To which Matthew Davis replied, does that mean the Coast City team is the Coasters and they're always holding everyone's beer? In which Ito agreed without a doubt. Past guest and friend of the network, Martin Gray, says, when you announced this episode, I didn't realize I had this issue. But seeing the cover, yes, I bought it at the time, probably because I was a fan of Plop. Ryan and I covered Steve Skates and Bernie Wrightson's The Gourmet from Plop Number 1 on this very network's Midnight Podcasting Hour way back in 2017. So as far as Kane's gargoyles go, I think Matt is correct. It's three separate gags, not one strip. Different people. Glad to hear another calculator double bill. I also love the musical Take Me Out to the Ball Game, which is what you call this story. This story is actually Take Me Out of the Ball Game. No, don't thank me. The reference remains. Fair point, Martin. Thanks again. The Hawkman art really is great, but that big free sound effect where a hero escapes his trap is a bit cheesy. Wonderful show, gents. Thanks, Martin. I always appreciate the comments, even when you're wrong about the cheesy special effects. Next up, Nate the Great said, Sergio may have been the first comics pro I met at a little con years ago. I got a bunch of things signed by him. I do think Gru is highly underrated, though, possibly because it's more for fans like us than the general public, like his Mad work. I think a couple of those calculator stories might have been rushed. Black Canary one was unbelievable, even for a superhero story. And I think Bob Rozek has missed the trick by not having the elongated man pitch Bugs Bunny style the Green Arrow team up. Good idea, Nate. Thanks for listening. Next up, Matthew Davis said, I don't know why, but I thought the whammy on the game show Press Your Luck was an Aragonis creation. If anything, the creators had to have been influenced by him. I've been loving the calculator recap, guys. It was around this time that I really got into DC. Maybe it's me, but at the time it seemed like serialized story arcs like this were not the norm for DC. I'm talking about something more than a two or a three-parter. There had been, of course, the Green Lantern, Green Arrow, Hard Traveling Heroes, and the Fourth World by Kirby. Those were centered around the heroes, but this was centered around multiple heroes fighting a common villain. Props for DC for experimenting like this, and for Bob Rozakis for delivering. I agree, Matthew, that's why it was so memorable for me. Next up, guest of this very episode, John Stieb, said, I thoroughly enjoy this episode, Paul and Matt, and not just because I'm excited about the next one. Again, to be honest, I don't think I would have bought this comic if I saw it on the spinner rack all those years ago. I love Sergio Aragonis, and I read Mad at some point in my comic reading life, but I always thought of him as the, quote, funny cartoons in the margin guy, as opposed to one of the artists who drew my, quote, serious superhero comics. I love the recap of the stories in the special. I had just assumed it was a book of one-page gags made up of the three panels like the cover. I must also confess I was always a little freaked out by the covers on Plop, so I don't think I would have picked them up either. I've enjoyed Gru when I've read it, But I really love the Sergio Massacres Marvel and the Sergio Destroys DC one-shots that he did. I'm so predictable in my comic book reading. Once again, thanks for another fun episode. And thank you, John. Great job on your real podcast debut here on this episode. Next up, Lizanne Oswald said, impressive podcast, most impressive. I like Sergio's work. Though I never read Gru, I started with Mad and some of the fanboy comics. I think he did the cartoon bits on the Ed McMahon and Dick Clark bloopers and practical jokes show. Him doing Cain and Abel is funny. Most of those bits are pretty good. The Pipeline story is real funny. Not a fan of the Elephant and the Clown. Eve joining Cain and Abel was fun, and the Shrunken Scientist and his wife was interesting. Anyway, can't wait for the next podcast. Thanks, Lizanne. Next up, Fire and Water All-Star and host of Peacebound and Down, a Wonder Woman podcast, Sean Ross. Truly fun episode. Aragonus is a legend. I can't picture Mad Magazine and not think of his work. The Elephant story made me think of the famous outtake from the Carol Burnett show, where during a Mama's Family skit, Tim Conway tells a story about conjoined elephants that makes the entire cast fall over laughing. I'll have to search that one out, Sean. Thanks for pointing that out. Next up, Hal said, it's been many years since I've read an issue of Mad. Sergio was always one of my favorites. The comment was made that Sergio spent so much time at the office, Bill Gaines allowed him to sleep there, and nobody else would allow that. Well, according to an article Jim Shooter wrote for the Overstreet Price Guide, it happened at Marvel, too. Shooter noted how he was interviewing at Marvel after he'd left DC. He was about to turn down their offer because he couldn't afford to live in New York. That's when Stan told him that many of Marvel's young artists and writers were actually, unofficially, sleeping at the offices overnight. Lee noted that was actually what he was referring to as the Marvel bullpen. That may explain also the hypercontinuity of early Marvel comics, since these guys not only work together, they also live together. And we all know what happens when geeks get together to discuss comics. Cool story, Hal. Thanks for sharing that. Next up, Fire and Water All-Star, past guest and host of The Fantastic Four, Brett Young. Great show, Paul and Matt. I always enjoyed Sergio Aragonés' work. I had no idea he was still around. The only work I have of his, except for the long disposed of Mad magazines, is issue 9 of Gru the Wanderer. I pulled it out to read after listening to the show. Still holds up. Terrific edition of Catch You Later Calculator. I always love a Green Arrow story. The art by Marshall Rogers is definitely raw, but a lot of fun. I'm guessing it was Terry Austin who was helping hold it together. By the way, the guy with the glasses who gives Green Arrow another baseball looks a lot like Billy Kuhn, the commissioner of Major League Baseball at the time. Great pull, Brett. I did not notice that. That's really cool. Rogers' art is already improving one issue later with the Hawkman story. The image of Hawkman in front of the plane is really striking. And I love the POW panel. Great stuff. And good job knowing what baseball is, Sean. Thanks, Brett. And finally, guest on that episode, Movie Matt Saroy said, thank you, Paul, for having me as a guest and editing the episode so well that I actually sound articulate and intelligent. You're welcome, Matt. And you didn't need any help from me. Thanks for being on the show. That's it for our comments. Thanks to everybody who wrote in. A reminder, if you're enjoying what you hear on the show or any of our network shows, please consider becoming a patron to help defray the costs. At certain levels, you can get a call out on the show of your choice or suggest an episode to the network. This episode's special thanks go out to our Sunday supporters, Al the Comics Guy, David Gutierrez, Gore Tolton, and Mike Atchison. To find out more, go to patreon.com/FWPodcast and thanks. That'll do it for the feedback section and for this episode. Special thanks to John Stive for being on this episode. Regardless of what Shag says, I found him first. Thanks for listening and hope to join me and David Steele next month for the Three Musketeers, Robin Hood, and the Vikings.